From the LifeWord Studios, this is Life Perspectives with Michael Goring.
Joining me today is four-time world champion and the 1984 Olympic gold medalist, figure skating legend, Scott Hamilton. Scott, thanks for joining me today. I've looked forward to this.
Oh, you're so kind. Thank you so much.
Well, so Scott, you've had an extraordinary life, from Olympic gold to cancer survivor to broadcaster. For those who may not be familiar with your full story, would you just briefly share the path that led you to become one of the most celebrated figure skaters in history?
How much time do you have?
We have 30 minutes.
It's kind of a long path. I was adopted at 6 weeks of age. My parents wanted to have a large family, and they were able to do that naturally. So my sister was born of my parents, and then they just decided adoption was their best option. So I was in this wonderful family. My parents were both school teachers growing up, having a blast, very active as a child. And then around age four, I stopped growing and I stopped developing. And so, they were scared, of course, and they didn't know anything about my family history. So they didn't know if this was supposed to happen or if this was just something unusual. And we're talking now early 60s. So they're what medicine wasn't then what it is now, So for the next 4 years, I was in and out of hospitals, and they were trying to come up with a diagnosis. I was misdiagnosed. I was not diagnosed. I was underdiagnosed. And finally, we went from Bowling Green, Ohio, where I grew up, to Toledo, thinking to go to a bigger hospital, bigger city, bigger doctors or something. And then we went to University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. They had a children's hospital there, and they couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. And then we went to Boston Children's Hospital. And this is where things kind of changed, because I had every symptom of a disease called Shwachman-Diamond syndrome, but they couldn't, like Dr. Shwachman himself, couldn't prove that I had it. And he said that if we couldn't figure out what was wrong, they didn't know how to treat it. So at that point, I was off sugar, I was off dairy, I was off flour. So birthday parties weren't a lot of fun, in those years.
I can't imagine.
Yeah. I can't eat that. So he just basically sent us home with marching orders of go home and live a normal life and see what happens, see if he grows out of it. See if it's just some sort of temporary thing. Again, we can't diagnose it. We can't treat it. So I went home to live a normal life. And it was really interesting that our family physician came over and realized that my parents at this point were burnt out physically, emotionally, financially, in every way possible. Just this four-year adventure of, trying to figure out what's going on with this child. And when I'd come down with this, whatever it was, they adopted another little boy. So without even knowing that they were going to have me going through all this high maintenance stuff, they were trying to raise another child. And it was very stressful. So our doctor said, you need a morning off to recharge your batteries. And they didn't really know how to do that. So he said, I wouldn't come with this intervention if I didn't have a plan. And my plan is, my daughters, he said, were in this great skating program at the brand new facility at Bowling Green State University. They have a beautiful skating rink, and from 8 to 12 every Saturday, they teach local children how to skate. So I went to the rink, and I realized that after a few weeks, I could skate as well kids. And then after a few more weeks, I could skate as well as the best athletes in my grade, and all of a sudden, I had self-esteem for the very first time. So I became a rink rat, which was fun. And I never wanted to get off the ice, and I just kept skating and started taking lessons and started taking the tests, all the figure tests, and started competing a little bit. And the rest is kind of history. It's all of it, in the beginning, you're growing up small town. We didn't have any culture for figure skating. So we had good coaches in the beginning, and then they left and went to another state and city and decided they were going to start their business there. So I, for a while I was taking from college students And then a pro from Fort Wayne, Indiana was coming over a couple of days a week to teach at Bowling Green. And then a coach from Germany moved into our town. He gave me my skating, my jumping technique. And then it became apparent that, you know, he had some health issues. And so I went to Illinois to skate. And it was there that I finally made it to the national championships, of which I came in dead last. And then I went back the next year and came in 9th out of 10. And you know, so I was always at the bottom, you know, for a long time. And then after my first year in junior, my mom came home with a very cheerful cancer diagnosis, which is odd. I think she understood family and she understood psychology and she understood, you know, that she didn't want us to fear. She wanted us to step into this with the joy and confidence that she was stepping into it with. Yeah. So she shared that and she said, you know, this is your last year in skating, make it great. We're broke. Okay. So I went back to where I was training and I had a new coach because my other one retired. The new one scared me to death and I ended up winning junior nationals that year. And my mom was very joyful at that competition. I couldn't figure out why. I just thought they had her on some pretty good drugs.
Yeah.
And because she'd lost her left breast. They removed it and they removed the inside of her left arm and she'd lost all her hair to chemotherapy and she was still just happy as could be. And at the end of the competition, you know, after I got my medal and my trophy and I never thought in a million years I'd ever be on the podium at a national championship. She just shared with me that on the way to the competition, she had a layover in Chicago where she was introduced to a couple that was very wealthy that loved skating and didn't want to have to see me quit. So they decided they would sponsor me. And so she knew the whole time that I had a second life in skating, but she didn't want to put that on me while I was competing. So she told me when I was done. And then I went to Colorado and took from a great coach. And you know, the first year I was kind of 18 and a knucklehead and lost and sort of didn't really know how to do anything right. And, you know, he was a good coach, but he wasn't going to babysit me either. So it's up to me to kind of show up with integrity and honesty and ambition. And I was just sort of like distracted and, you know, I just didn't know what to do. And so I came in 9th at the senior nationals first year. I was on the senior level. And then my mom passed right after that. And it was that I grew up. I decided she always dreamed that I would go to the Olympics someday. And I was always at the bottom of the results. And I was like, okay, based on what, you know?
Yeah.
And then I won junior nationals and it looked like, well, now I'm ahead of a lot of other guys, but then I kind of squandered that the next year. And then that was the last competition she saw me skate in. And I just grew up overnight. I just said, I gotta be better. I've gotta be stronger. I've gotta honor her. So from then on, I was better. that year after I lost her, I was 3rd in the country and 11th in the world. And then
what year was that?
1978.
Okay.
And then in 79, my coaching situation was sort of under stress. My biggest competition, my biggest competitor, my arch rival decided he wanted to come and take from my coach, and my coach accepted him. Wow. So I got injured that year. You know, I just wasn't ready to compete every day on the ice. And I got injured, fell behind a little bit, didn't make it to the Worlds that year. I ended up 4th at Nationals. And my sponsors came and said, hey, look, if you want to switch to a different coach, you know, we'll stay with you. And there was a coach that was looking after me a little bit when my main coach couldn't. And we had a great relationship. So I ended up talking to my main coach and I said, things didn't go well this year. And if you want me to stay, I'll stay. But if you you know, if you don't care, then I'll go to Don Laws in Philadelphia. And he said, well, I like Don. Don's a good guy. And he said, if you want to take from him, I promise I won't hurt you politically, and I won't, I'll just leave you alone. And he never said stay. So yeah. I said, hey, I guess I'm going to Philadelphia. So I moved to Philadelphia, and Don taught me how to really step it up as far as my discipline and as far as my accountability. And I went that year to the Nationals, came in third, made the Olympic team, and went to Lake Placid, came in fifth. The subsequent World Championships, a month later, I came in fifth. And then about a month after that, I realized that the top three guys from Lake Placid and World Championships, you know, the same guys, decided they were going to turn pro. One went to medical school and the other turned professional. So all I had to do was wake up and I'm ranked second in the world. That's a pretty good cup of coffee. And so, so from there, I had to figure out how to win. And I realized that I didn't really like the compulsory figures. That's the figure eights. You trace eights on the ice. And
yeah, sure.
What I learned is if you don't like a part of your job, it tends to not like you back.
Yep.
So I wasn't very good at them. And I decided I was going to put my head down and just change the relationship. And I did. And I was able to improve my results in the compulsory figures. And then that made me basically unbeatable for the next 4 years. I was able to go undefeated. And then at that kind of, you know, the last two competitions in that streak were the Olympics in Sarajevo in 1984, where I won a gold medal, and then the World Championships in Ottawa, Canada, was my fourth world title. And then I decided after that it was time to get a job, because I was broke and living in my best friend's parents' basement.
Well, so let's go back there for just a moment. You're standing on the Olympic podium.
Yeah.
In Sarajevo, 1984. What was that moment? Was there a moment when you're standing there that you sensed God was doing something bigger through your story?
You know, I always believed, but I didn't really know how to approach him. Like, I always felt like I was never alone. I always felt like I was covered. I always felt like there was something bigger happening in my life. I just didn't know who was behind that or how that worked. And so my parents, when we were younger, we'd go to Sunday school, and they really wanted us to know about faith and learn and grow about, you know, the story of God the Father and Jesus the Son and the Holy Spirit. But we just never really, it was never really practice. It was sort of something we did on Sundays as a family. But I always believed in God. Always believed in God. I didn't know much about Jesus at the time, but I always believed in God. And ironically, when I went to skate in Illinois, Janet Lynn was at the rink where I skated, and she was the most popular woman athlete in the world at that time, and very, very, very devout Christian and an evangelist everywhere she went. Everybody wanted to be like Janet. So I started reading the Bible, and I just didn't understand it. But I knew he was there. I just didn't know how to approach him. So throughout all those competitions and everything, there was prayer, you know, always when you're putting yourself in that. I think even the most agnostic person, when they're up against it, they're going to pray. You know, they just are.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I believed. I just didn't know where to start. And, you know, as I went into the professional world, it was, you know, it was a whole different set of people. And there weren't many people practicing faith in that world. Mm-hmm. And so I remember specific moments where, you know, I just, you know, different things that happened where I just was on my knees just praying. And then I guess it was 13 years into my professional career. I always thought if I skated 2 years, maybe four, I was fooling a lot of people. But when I got to year 13, it was 2 months shy of the 20th anniversary of losing my mom to cancer. Wow. That I'm 50 cities into a 60 city tour, and I couldn't stand up straight anymore. And I went into an emergency room just casually to get some ulcer medicine or whatever. And they said they found a mass and it was either benign, malignant, or something else. And I realized there that something bigger was happening. Like I have cancer. Hmm. And then, you know, the initial reaction is normal. It's like, you know, fear, you know, picturing yourself succumbing and, you know, just suffering and all that stuff. And then all of a sudden it just became this sense of authority and like, no, I'm going to be the best patient they've ever had. And I'm going to be right back on tour next year. And I'm just going to get through this. Right. So it goes from fear. And it's funny because I heard somebody say once, and it's an older quote, that courage is just fear that said its prayers, you know? So
yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and, yeah. So, I mean, there is no courage without fear. Right.
And, yeah.
Yeah. So I guess in that, you know, the going through chemo and the surgery, 38 staple surgery and everything, I kind of got to a point where I realized that I was given a second chance and my mom wasn't. So now I have an obligation to do something with my second chance. So I kind of stepped away from the way I was living and I kind of went to a place where I could be somewhat, you know, kind of living on my own terms. And that was Los Angeles, California, because, you know, people live behind hedges, fences, walls, and yeah, they all live in their cars, you know, so I figure I can find a way to kind of be quiet there, yeah, and, you know, get ready for tour there without it being, and just step away.
Yeah.
And I really didn't feel like I wanted to have a relationship with anyone because I just felt damaged and worn out and beat up. And then on the third anniversary of my diagnosis, I'm doing a show in Memphis. And Tony Thomas, who is Danny Thomas's son, Stars and Ice was benefiting St. Jude, Target House at St. Jude,
yeah,
those years. And he had a guest at the show, and I thought it was a date. So I was curious. And so I just sort of saw her by the production office after the show, and I introduced myself and talked to her for about 10 minutes. And something shifted really big. And I was like, well, that's Tony's date. I can't have a crush on Tony's date. That'd be weird. You know, that's not right. But later I found out a few months later, I was playing golf with Tony and he was on the phone with I could tell it was a girl. And he said, I said, is that the girl from Memphis? And he said, Tracy. And I said, I don't know her name. Is that the girl from Memphis? And he said, did you like her? And I said, man, a little bit, you know. And he said, you know, I think she's moving to LA this week. And I said, can I get her number? And we went out a few weeks later and we've been together ever since. And in our dating, we were dating probably for about a month. And she said, where are you in your faith? I need to know.
Wow. Wow.
And I said, where do you want me to be? Because I'm a smart guy.
Yeah.
And she said, no, seriously. And I said, well, I believe in God. I just don't know how to approach him, basically.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's all these denominations and all these separations and all this legalism. And I could see it, you know, kind of from the outside looking in. It's like, how do I jump into this pool and where?
Yeah.
So I met Ken Durham, who is a preaching minister, senior pastor at the University Church of Christ at the Pepperdine in Malibu. And I just told him all my concerns and misgivings about sort of the, you know, religion. And he goes, I couldn't agree with you more. Let's get started. And yeah, so I got started. I'm learning. And it's really amazing that I just started getting more answers to more questions. It's like, So I look at cancer as the greatest thing that ever happened to me because it pulled me away from sort of my ways, you know, and it pulled me away from being, totally dedicated to the world. And now I could live for something higher and better. Mm-hmm. And it's been really fun to grow. You know, every day I learn something, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and I think most theologians, you know, if they're really paying attention, they probably learn something every day too. So, sure, you know, sure, we're on equal footing, you know.
Whoop,
so I'm a man of faith. I'm loud and proud about that. And you know, it's funny, Jim Gash, who's now the president of Pepperdine, University. He was one of the guys that I went to church with, and he stepped in for Ken one Sunday and he gave a sermon, and he just, you know, he said, first of all, I want you to know there's no such thing as a coincidence. Everything is a God-scheduled opportunity.
Yeah.
And every synapse in my brain started firing because all of a sudden I could start connecting the dots. And I could see where he was there. I could see where he protected me. I could see where he held my hand. I could see where he saw me through. I could see it all in a really profound and very vivid way. So I love the Lord. You know, I am so grateful for everything that he's done to, you know, save a wretch like me and bring me out of, you know, and I had a lot of losing in the early days, and then I had a lot of winning, and I don't know which one's worse. Yeah. You know, my Bible study, we came to a really profound understanding that if you really want to see the deepest, darkest part of someone's character, just give them fame and or money. And I lived that. I saw it. It was like, you know, this too easy. You know, it's like, yeah, things are coming at me at light speed, and it's like, I'm not prepared for this. And you know, you start to get, you know, anxious, and you start to get, you know, sort of fighting for your, you know, quiet and your anonymity, and it just doesn't work, you know. It just, so I'm really grateful that I was able to connect those dots and understand that nothing in my life has ever been an accident. In fact, the disease I had as a child was finally, we believe, diagnosed in 2004. I was diagnosed with a pituitary brain tumor. Mm-hmm. And they're a brain tumor that a child is born with, and they usually show up due to a lack of growth and development. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's been an extraordinary journey. And I always joke with people that all questions will be answered if you live long enough.
Wow.
So just stay alive, and all questions will be answered at some point.
So, Scott, let me ask you this. We're kind of talking about the cancer journey you've been on. Some that are watching today might be walking through health struggles themselves, or disappointments, or loss. What encouragement do you have to offer them, especially those who may be struggling to see God's goodness in their suffering?
Oh, well, God is good all the time. It's just this world is kind of broken, you know, and you can really see it everywhere. And it's just, but the world's broken. You don't have to be, you know. Yeah. That's the one thing I've learned is, you know, and my kids now, they're getting really anxious about, you know, this has happened and that has happened. And, you know, you got all this world and war, and you've got people that are angry with other people, and they're just trying to figure it all out. And I just say, I don't really allow it to undermine my joy. I just go to the Word, and I'm fine. And the rest of it, I can't control. You know, we have so many news sources now. We have so many ways of learning it, you know, like somebody dropped a thumbtack in India, and we're going to know about it, right? It's like, we're not right. meant to know all those things, and sure. we're not equipped to handle it. So
yeah.
I look at most news as propaganda, you know, somebody's yeah. Yeah. take on something, and just give me the Bible, and I'm going to find a way to be okay. But, you know, for those that are, you know, going through periods of suffering, yeah, I just really feel like, you know, we are created, We are very fragile, very vulnerable to countless things, whether it be injury or disease. We're also extremely resilient. We've got that going for us, but we're ultimately temporary.
Yeah.
So in that is, you know, living in the tension of all of that is kind of life. And I look at it as like sand in the hourglass, right? There's always so much sand you can fit in the hourglass. I think all of us just want more sand. Just yeah. give me more sand. And you know, I've had a bunch of health, you know, things over the years, you know, between the cancer, you know, the childhood illness, which we found out later was the brain tumor. But the brain tumor came back again in 2010 and again in 2016. And when it came back in 2010, after they did radiation in 2004, that was great. 6 years later, it comes back, and it felt like a gut punch. But God was everywhere and that everywhere. I just so many stories from that period. One surgery became nine. It was complicated. And then went back to life. And 6 years later, it came back again. And you'd think that, you know, based on, you know, the repetition of this thing, that I'd be really scared. But it was really wild that in the meeting with the doctors, I just felt this overwhelming thing in my spirit to just get strong. And they gave me a medical option, and they gave me a surgical option. And they said, what do you want to do? And I said, I'm going to go home and get strong. And they said, what does that look like? And I said, I have no idea. So I went back, and I had to figure out if I was supposed to get strong physically or emotionally or intellectually or spiritually. And so I chose all the above. Mm-hmm. And it was really remarkable that a couple of things happened. One, with each subsequent scan, the tumor was shrinking. It stayed the same first one, then it shrank twice, then it grew, then it shrunk, then it grew. And I was like, I think I'm done looking at this. But when I went into the Bible and I heard Jesus say that you are to love the Lord with all of your strength, all of your heart, all of your mind, and all of your soul, I thought, oh, that's where I got that. You know, it came in really handy.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's just the Holy Spirit. You know, He just convicts us of things and just allows us to step into things if we just trust in Him. And I haven't looked at it, and I guess it's coming up on 9 years. It's been 9 years. And so, you know, when you look at 2004, 2010, 2016, I think a pattern has emerged, and I just decided to just throw that away and just live my life. And if I'm symptomatic, of course, I'm going to go in and check it out again. But, you know, I think the Lord's looked after me in a really profound way, because obviously there's something for me to be doing.
Yeah.
And so I think He's just waiting for me to do that, and then He'll bring me home.
Well, and Scott, I want to touch on something you just said. The Scott Hamilton Cares Foundation, mm-hmm, is something that's making a real difference in the world of cancer research and patient care.
Yeah, we are. We work really hard. Yeah, we're just getting started too. I think we're going
to. What inspired you to start the foundation, and how have you seen God work through that to bring hope to others facing cancer?
It's really been remarkable. You know, when I went through my cancer, well, first, when I lost my mom, I became a fundraiser, right? I was going to raise money for cancer research wherever I could to honor her and to hopefully find a treatment for the, because she had nothing. They just threw everything they could at her. She had nothing. So I became a fundraiser. And then 20 years later, I survived cancer, and I decided that it's time for me to become more of an activist, because now I know what it feels like to go through it. So we created the Cancer Alliance for Research, Education, and Survivorship. That's CARES, CARES. And in that, you know, the first things first, I wanted to check some pain points that I had when I was going through my cancer. Like, I didn't know how I was doing. No one could tell me, because no one had gone through what I was going through, right? So we created the Fourth Angel Mentoring Program. The first angel is your oncologist. Your second angel is your oncology nurse. You can rotate those however you want. Yeah. Third angel is your friends and family. And then the fourth angel is missing. Fourth angel is somebody who's been there, done that, that can guide you and be a role model, a life coach, whatever, just to get you through just sort of that day-to-day, not medical advice at all, but just day-to-day. We've expanded that to caregivers, because they're co-survivors, and then pediatric caregivers. And that's still going on at the Cleveland Clinic. And they match 100 people a month, 100 people that need a mentor a month. And that's thriving. And then we created a website called chemocare.com that really describes everything about the chemotherapy experience, how the drugs work, and associated side effects in eighth grade English and Spanish. And then it was back to focusing totally on research. And 10 years ago, we became a dedicated foundation. I've been doing this since 2000. So this is 25 years. The first 15 were with the Cleveland Clinic. And then the last 10 were as an independent foundation, because I can make a greater impact as an independent foundation than I can being an activity within an organization. So we've been funding immunotherapy research. We said we're going to treat the cancer and spare the patient harm. So that's why our cancer ribbon is upside down, because we're turning cancer upside down. We want it to go from fear and suffering and diminishing and succumbing to hope, survivorship, you know, life and joy and survive, you know, and celebration. So we went all in on immunotherapy. And 3 years after we did that, the first drug was approved, CAR T, a T cell manipulation therapy, which is amazing. It's using your own immune system to fight the cancer. And 3 years ago, we found a study that was for my mom's cancer. Wow. An immunotherapy study for my mom's cancer. And on the night of my 40th anniversary of my Olympic gold medal, I'm with Brian Orser, who is my silver medalist, and Joseph Ovchick, my bronze medalist. We couldn't wait to be together. We haven't been together, like, just together in 10 years, you know?
Wow.
And, or 20 years. So, so we were laughing and enjoying this thing. And in my talking points, I was able to announce that study, that research project that we funded, that CARES funded, was going into clinical trial. So it's remarkable that, you know, 47 years after I lost my mom, now after all that work, you know, we come up with something that may be able to give people a greater quality of life, you know, destroying their cancer.
Scott Hamilton, you are the epitome of resilience. I am thankful for this engaging conversation today.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks for joining me today on this program. And to learn more about Scott Hamilton, I encourage you to visit his website, scotthamilton.com, or to learn more about Scott Hamilton CARES Foundation for Cancer Research, visit scottcares.org. Until next time, I'm Michael Goring, and this has been Life Perspectives. Thanks for watching.